Manny, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you based at the moment? You're in Southland or just across the Otago border?
Just north of the Southland border. So we're in South Otago, but we experience most of the weather patterns and same sort of land as Southland.
Okay, yeah. So lots of rain. I've taken a while to adjust to it, but I'm now one of those people who walk my dog without a rain jacket on. So I feel I've adjusted to the
weather. I've just dropped my little boy off at his rural kindy, and even though it's sort of 9 degrees out there, everyone's wearing shorts and t-shirts.
Okay, I'm not that adjusted yet. So you're on dairy farm. Maybe just tell me, are you farming also? Is it just your partner?
Yeah, so hubby and I are on a 930 cow dairy farm here in Clydevale in South Otago. We supply A2 milk to Matera Valley Milk, which is awesome. We love working with them. Pete's the main farmer. He is definitely the one out there alongside our fantastic team of staff. I do lots in the background and also work off farm.
Okay, cool. And what would you describe as your day job at the moment?
Yeah, I'm really fortunate to be in a real, I've had a real mixture of a day job. So part of my role is Navigate, like you mentioned. So that's a consultancy I've set up in the field that we're going to talk about today, which came out of my Kellogg Rural Leadership Project, looking at risk of alt protein to the dairy industry. Yeah. So I'm quite involved in sort of the wider industry, looking at big picture elements. Within the farm, I do some of our environmental compliance stuff, our carbon emissions data, and pulling all of that stuff together. And then I also teach swimming randomly. That's extra that I do on the side, and I do some consulting and contracting work for catchment groups and for council.
Okay, so never bored, I assume.
Never bored, no. Yeah. I love things that are in sort of the communications and sort of explaining complex science, maybe reframing things in a different way. That's where I come from.
But you're in essence a food scientist, right? Is that's your background?
Yeah, so academic background a while ago now, but I have a degree in food science and nutrition from the UK, and then started working for one of the major supermarkets over there called Sainsbury's. I was really fortunate to do an awesome grad scheme. So the first year of that, we got to travel around the world, work for suppliers in different countries. So I got to go to Central America, New Zealand, where I met my husband. Where else did I go? Senegal in Africa, and a couple of other places too. It was really interesting just seeing how food's produced globally and then the different factors that affect food production around the world.
That's awesome. It's always good to see that completely different context. And it just, we used to have my wife and I used to have a supper club with a couple of friends, and there were two food scientists in the supper club. And they were always the best people to have on the team because their cooking skills were exceptional.
I'm not sure my husband would vouch for it, but he is celiac. So like the food science background does help with that and sort of understanding food factories and auditing and that side of things.
Yeah, good. So we really spoke, I think it was in 2021. I can't remember actually, but you brought out a paper in Kellogg. Okay. Well, actually, no. Let me reverse a bit. Let's talk about the New Zealand dairy market so listeners that are not in the country, that are not Kiwis, can understand. How does the New Zealand dairy market look briefly, and what is its biggest kind of why does it bring in money into the country?
Yeah, so it's our biggest export earner alongside tourism. Yeah. And obviously with everything that happened with COVID, tourism took a back seat. So dairy and to some extent red meat picked up the slack there. Yeah. New Zealand is really unusual from a dairy perspective. So in a global context, only about 10% of all the dairy production in the world crosses an international border. Mm. So most dairy is produced in the country where it's consumed, whether that's as liquid milk or cheese or yogurt. for New Zealand, we are between a quarter and a fifth of all of that dairy that crosses an international border. And that puts us in a really unique position with pros and cons. So we've got lots and lots of grassland, and we can grow lots of grass. We can feed cows. We have a very seasonal production. And again, there's pros and cons to that. But what it ultimately means is that we need to produce a product with our milk that stores for a long time, can be transported. Milk is 87% water. It doesn't really make any sense to ship that water around the world currently. Mm. And for that reason, we tend to make a lot of ingredients and powders. So we are 55% of all of the global exports of whole milk powder. So little old New Zealand is a huge proportion of that dairy ingredients market. And that's really key to some of the conversations that we need to be having as an industry.
And for someone who doesn't know, whole milk powder is used as ingredient in chocolate, in confectionery, and some pharmaceutical products also, as far as I understand.
Yeah, bits and pieces. So pharmaceutical products for feeding through feeding tubes will use very specific fractions of milk powder. It's also used for reconstitution into some dairy products, but it tends to be the lower end of the market.
Okay.
That uses powders rather than fresh milk.
So New Zealand exports the bulk of the milk it produces in powder form, and it brings in a lot of money. And then at some stage, you started ringing the alarm bell and saying, the way science is going, this could be replaced. Like, just why did you ring the alarm bell? And yeah, just talk me maybe even through the article you wrote for Kellogg and just, yeah, why you started ringing that alarm bell.
So living on a dairy farm and understanding milk production and how we produce milk on the farm, and then working inside dairy factories and seeing how that milk is processed into powders and ingredients, and the scale and the types of products that we produce from New Zealand, I was really intrigued by the messages we were getting as farmers about where our milk goes.
Yeah.
So we see lots of images of people drinking glasses of milk, and we're told we're feeding the world and we're doing all these really good things. And that's really lovely. You know, like, I'm looking out the window, I can see the cows in the dairy shed, and I love the idea of we're providing really high nutrition products to people that really need it. But that didn't all add up with what I was seeing in the dairy factories. They're incredible operations. We have got so much knowledge and expertise in producing these products, but what we are producing is mainly ingredients.
Yeah.
And there's a gap between those ingredients and where we sort of talk about our milk going.
Yeah.
And so that was a real beginning of a journey, doing that Kellogg report and starting to find the sources of information, really digging into what it is we produce and where it goes. And the second part of that, obviously, is the alternatives that are out there in the world. So not looking at things like oat milk and liquid milk alternatives, because ultimately that's not how our customers are consuming New Zealand milk.
Yeah.
Our customers are consuming ingredient powders that go into Kit Kats and you know, they're reconstituted into sort of yogurt products, things like that. So those are the alternatives we need to be focused on.
Yeah.
And actually, when you think about that element, there are viable alternatives where maybe the nutrition isn't so important, the production system of grass-fed, outdoor-reared, happy cows isn't so important. The things that are important are quality, consistency, availability, all of which New Zealand has nailed because of the sheer scale of our system and the success of Fonterra and Open Country and businesses like that. We make a beautiful quality product that if Nestle want to pour into their Kit Kat machines, they know that it's going to turn out the same every time.
Yeah.
Consistent. And that's often why we're used.
Yeah. And I mean, you started sounding the alarm bell that basically the milk can be replaced, as far as I understand. And some people might not think it's a big deal, but if I look at it's over $7 billion worth to the economy. So this is a massive massive deal for the economy, and obviously it's a massive deal because there are literally thousands of farmers out there. So what did you say could be the alternative? Like, what is out there that is the alternative?
So alternatives to ingredient products, there's three key elements we talk about. So the first one is plant-based, and plant-based is not new. I mean, I mentioned oat milk before. That's not really an alternative to what we're producing.
Yeah.
But compounds taken from oats, or combining different soy proteins with chickpea proteins that can then be used in processed food, that is an alternative. So if you look at Nestle's vegan Kit Kat, they use different rice extracts to give that same or similar taste profile and texture and bulking. So within plant-based, there's also a new field coming out called molecular farming, which sounds stranger than fiction, but we've got a really cool New Zealand company called Maruku who are looking to do this. So they're using safflower, which is an oilseed crop. They're genetically modifying it to express casein protein. That casein protein is what makes cheese really stretchy and gooey and does all the cool cheesy things. What is different about that is that it's produced inside an oilseed crop, which there is already a supply chain for, there's already processing for that exists. So ultimately what that produces is an oil that contains a dairy protein, and that whole thing can be used to make a cheese type product. It's got the fat, it's got the dairy protein, and there's not that whole need for a huge new scale up of new facilities, and it utilizes the whole of the crop.
Yeah, you're basically so just telling the farmer to plant a different seed that he would usually plant. It's the arable farmer. And then of course there's precision fermentation, right?
Yes, there's precision fermentation. So that's the second one. So that's again genetically modifying a microorganism. So some companies use yeast and some use bacteria. You get those microorganisms to express the molecule that you want. So historically, that's always been used in the pharmaceutical industry to produce things like insulin for diabetics. That's been for the last 40 years or so, a technology that's existed. It's also used in really common foods that we eat every day. So, you know, whether you're eating vanilla flavoring, whether it's vitamin D fortified into your food, whether it's any vitamins that you get that say that they're vegan, it's probably been produced by precision fermentation. So it's definitely not a new technology, it's just a new application of an existing technology, and that's being used to produce dairy proteins. Whey is available commercially. Lactoferrin is a really cool bioactive component of whey protein, and that's being produced. It's just being launched at the moment. And then there's multiple companies working on casein, which is a really cool functional dairy protein.
So are we at a stage yet where there's big enough scale to just simply replace all the milk that New Zealand has produced? How far is that away?
We're a way away from that. But what it's important to understand is that the composition of milk. So again, when milk's being drunk as whole milk, that whole product is used. We're in New Zealand, we're breaking it down into its constituent parts, whether that's whole milk powder or whether that's we have a whole industry in producing whey and casein individual proteins, which are used as ingredients. Now, the export revenue from that industry alone is roughly equivalent to our export revenue from lamb, which is what we're really famous for. So just that one single part of the industry, which actually utilizes waste product from the industry. So the caseins and the whey are removed from other products that we're making, other ingredient products that we're making, and those have been commercialized. A lot of them go to the United States. And they're used to fortify foods with higher protein. So even if we take that one subsection, it not only is possibly replaceable by precision fermentation most easily, but it also helps subsidize some of our other production. So, you know, when you make cheese, you get your whey that comes off the cheese. Those when those waste proteins are spray dried and made into a powder, that's another revenue stream for that product.
Yeah.
If there's nowhere for that to go because whey is being produced via precision fermentation, that actually increases the cost to produce cheese as well.
And then obviously there's the incentive for companies to do it because, well, to perhaps in future buy such a product because we've got the whole climate thing playing into this. How does the climate, play into this and the goals that companies are wanting to reach, but will probably be mandatory to reach in future?
Yeah, so if you look at, I always go on about Nestle, but they are Fonterra's biggest customer, and they're a really good example of the types of products that dairy is used for.
Yeah.
So if you think about Nestle's portfolio, yes, they do infant formula and sort of milk drinks, like Milo and things like that, but they also make confectionery and baked goods and frozen pizzas with frozen mozzarella on them. So they're a really good example of where some of our dairy ingredients go to. They have made a commitment to be net zero emissions, including their supply chain, by 2050.
Yeah.
And their scope 3 emissions, which are those emissions that come out of their supply chain, are the vast majority of the emissions that they create. And therefore, they're getting the biggest focus from Nestlé. So they released a report last week on their sustainability update. And in multiple places in that report, it mentions removing animal proteins and swapping them for plant proteins. And that's really key for us as New Zealand dairy farmers, because ultimately that's where our products end up. The technology, not just precision fermentation, but actually being able to use different components of plants to do the real technically food sciencey stuff inside those products, is advancing at a rapid rate. And it's being driven a lot by companies like Nestle, with huge R&D budgets as well, that are looking to reduce their emissions by moving away from methane emitting production methods where they can.
Yeah, so the argument for people who do not follow it, the argument is cows emit methane is bad, warms the planet, and if you can cut that out, then there's a whole host of benefits, whether you believe it or not. So it's interesting because you posted about Nestle, I think it was last week, and there's three paragraphs that you posted were interesting. They're talking about reformulation of recipes. I copied and pasted from your
okay. That's what it's there for.
They talked about reformulation of recipes to maintain the quality and taste of their products while reducing emissions by 0.74 million tons by 2030. By replacing some animal proteins with plant-based ingredients, and then they can achieve net zero commitment. You put in the chocolate icon, I think, constantly assessing opportunities to reduce our product's footprint through changing recipes and using alternative ingredients, like you just said, and then leveraging expertise in plant proteins to expand dairy alternative offerings. And then they talked about a differentiation approach between suppliers of fresh dairy, and in brackets, milk sourced direct from farmers and processed in Nestle factories, which is over which affects over 150,000 farms in 27 countries. And okay, so I'm going to leave that there. My question to you is, why, when I hear you saying, listen, we've got to worry about it, is my knee-jerk reaction, no, Anna, you're wrong. We need to get this stuff from cows. So yes, why do you think my knee-jerk reaction is that, and I don't want to believe it, and I want to like keep the status quo?
I don't want to believe it either. I don't want to. And actually, when you look at the industry organizations that we trust to give us information, particularly as farmers, no one seems to talk about this, and it's really interesting to me. So when you look at the banks, you know, they should have a real vested interest in upcoming risks to the industry. And actually, you look at the most recent report Rabobank put out about alternative proteins and sort of calling them hype. And in a global context, there has been a lot of hype. But from our specific context, I don't think it is all just hype. And that's not based on you know, a quick Google, that is based on 6 or 7 years of being really fully invested in this subject. When you look at organizations like Dairy NZ, their remit finishes at the farm gate. So they're really into looking at farm systems, how we can maximize our profitability. And I've been working with the team down in this region a bit recently, and I am doing some talks for them in the coming weeks. I was at a meeting with their chief science guy, Bruce, who's awesome, and director, Dr. Jacqueline Roweth, on Tuesday this week. And I challenged them on this because it's really important. And, you know, they reiterated the fact that their remit finishes at the farm gate. And one thing they said they are doing is looking at how we can reduce our emissions to make our products as sort of cheaply and as low emissions as possible. So that's kind of their take on it. So Dairy NZ, you know, they're more on farm rather than looking at the market side of things. And their pushback was it should be the processors that are doing this work. And of course they are, you know, they are. Like Fonterra have got a spin-off company, or they've invested in a company alongside DSM Firmenich in the Netherlands. So Firmenich already use precision fermentation to produce flavors and colors and ingredients for the food industry. And with it last year, they released a precision fermentation whey protein product. And if you look at all their marketing, they talk about it being better. They talk about it being, you know, lactose free, talk about the amino acid composition. And they also talk about how they've got really good expertise and experience inside the dairy supply chain, which of course they do from Fonterra. But I don't see that message getting through to farmers. And it's a really tricky one because there isn't a nice, neat, tidy answer. And so I feel like there's no one in the space helping people understand what it looks like from a big picture.
How do you think people perceive you? Like, are they like, oh, Anna Bending again?
Like, to be honest.
Doomsday prophecy, or are they receptive and just don't know how to handle the topic because this is such a big part of our economy and we can't foresee a shift? Like, how are you perceived, do you think?
I'm often perceived as being anti-dairy, pro alternative protein. And it's sad in a way that they're sort of such polar opposites. And yes, there's been a lot of hype, which I mentioned, but there are, it's not two different entities that should be against each other. What I'm trying to do is simply understand the science, try and cut through the hype and understand where there are actually risks. And I think too often in New Zealand, we assess the risks from alternatives for our agriculture industry as a whole, so meat and dairy. I think meat's in an entirely different position to dairy. It's consumed as a whole cut. There's lots of different proteins, fats, textures. You're a lot more connected to what it is when you're consuming it. Whereas with dairy, like I said, 87% water. The rest is milk solids, so 13% milk solids, 5% of that is a sugar, lactose, which 2/3 of the world's population have a level of malabsorption to. So that remains like 8% of that Fonterra milk tanker that is actually saleable. So it's really, it's not a huge proportion of that milk that we produce that would need to be substituted or replaced to cause issues.
Okay, so then the other argument that, I mean, you've seen me post, sometimes I post before I think on LinkedIn, but so I posted something yesterday, I think, about a photo of milk in a supermarket, well, it was out of my brother's fridge, that had vitamin A and vitamin D and palmitate added. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the argument that this does not give us the same level of nutrition.
That's one of our the normal pushbacks in New Zealand. You know, milk's really nutritious. It's a real cocktail of lots of different nutrients. Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. Like I'm sat here drinking a coffee using milk from our vat on the farm. Like I love it. I love feeding it to my 2-year-old. I think milk's amazing. I just want to put that out there loud and clear. Like I love it. When it's sort of all, when what we do in New Zealand is we separate it into the components and it's put into things where nutrition isn't one of the key selling factors, i.e. confectionery or baked goods, or you're not necessarily getting that nutritional value from it anyway. I totally agree. Like milk as milk, it's really scary to see the number of teenagers switching to things like oat milk at a time when calcium is so important to helping their bone structure grow, because you can only put down calcium in your bones until about the age of 30. So really those ages that are sort of switching to different milks, it's quite scary. But just to clarify, that isn't really how our New Zealand milk can be used.
Yeah, well, I like it goes into chocolate, so you're already the other argument is, and I think you posted a comment on my post, and I've seen you bring it up in other places, is that there's going to be pushback from consumers. And one of our food scientist friends that used to come to dinner at our place, I asked her, why is the taste of chocolate changing? Like, I used to buy, I think it was Kit Kat or something. I said, like, am I just getting older? It's my taste, but
it happens.
And she said, well, it might be the case, but producers or companies like Nestle are always looking for cheaper products. They replace one value chain, there's pressure on them because they've got increased costs. And she says, that's just it. Like, if you find a cheaper product and it tastes very similar, you replace it. And if you do a bit of, I don't know if I should admit this on air that I do that, but when I go grocery shopping, I look at what other people buy because I'm really.
Oh, me too. I love it.
And then sometimes I'm like, seriously, are you going to feed that to your kids? But not everyone is super conscious or educated about nutrition. Will there be a public acceptance of this? Will it not be public acceptance? Why will or won't there be? What do you think?
It goes back to those key consumer drivers, doesn't it? Price, taste, convenience. And yes, we'd love to think sustainability comes into the mix. And for generations coming through the ranks and starting to make some of the major purchasing decisions for households, that will start to play a role. But price, taste, convenience. So when you talk about your, if you used to buy Kit Kat and the taste's changing, it probably is. A good example is I'm not sure if it was Kit Kat or Cadbury's, someone moved away from using dairy fat to using vegetable oil.
Yeah.
Again, probably for a price reason, possibly for an emissions reduction reason. And while consumers aren't necessarily voting for sustainability with their purchase decisions currently, it's the massive targets that these companies like Nestle, Mars, Danone have made to the governments and as part of their corporate sustainability reporting, that will be driving them to make decisions based on the sustainability elements. It's not a consumer purchase driver. But the other side of it is why people buy products. So if you're buying fruit and vegetables or meat or a bottle of milk to pour in your cereal, I think people care and they connect about where those have come from a lot more than if you're at the checkout, you've got your stuff on the belt, and then you just really fancy a chocolate bar, so you pop a crunchy on the on the belt, which I'm known to do probably far too often.
The island spin when you walk in and there's all these chocolates.
Yeah, and you don't have that same level of consciousness about the ingredients that go into that. It's much more of an impulse decision. You know that it's got lots of different ingredients in. You're not really sure how it's produced. Mm. It's not really something you think too much about. I do, because I love food factories. I became a food scientist because I love, like, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is my favorite thing in the world. To the point where I had a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory birthday party as a kid.
Oh, that's like, that's
the level. But yeah, it's a different purchase decision for consumers. And actually, when you look at lots of dairy products, they already contain ingredients that have either been produced from plants to replicate dairy. Margarine, think about you know, I use Buttersoft on my little boy's sandwiches, the Lewis Road Creamery one, because it tastes really good. But actually, that's a blend of butter and vegetable oil to make it spreadable for convenience reasons. When you look at something like cheese, that contains rennet, which is made by precision fermentation. So even some of these really natural, in commas, products that we think that we're buying to feed to our children, they already contain ingredients that we don't fully understand. Xanthan gum. Xanthan gum is actually produced by bacteria. It's like this coating that they produce. It's kind of cool from a science perspective, but kind of gross from a eating perspective. And that's we don't have that connection with the ingredients.
I spend a lot of time when I'm shopping, looking at the back of packets, seeing what's in there. And my wife is a an environmental scientist. Hires me along all the time because I'm nutrition obsessed, probably more than I should be. I think it's bordering on a condition at some stage. So companies are trying to reduce. I mean, I don't think this is to do with food security. There's a lot of it that probably, this is just my idea, has to do with just making money, because you have to be the first in. I worry about nutrition. I worry about IP control by companies. But there are there's a push for regen. Like, where do you think something like regenerative agriculture, and there's already collaborations between Fonterra and between Nestle on the regenerative ag front. Like, how is regen going to fit into this? Is this going to bring a bit of a balance? Is it going to be how do you see regen fitting in? Do you see regen fitting in at all into this whole conversation?
100%, especially from a Nestle perspective, because they've highlighted regen as one of their key routes towards that net zero target.
Yeah.
One thing we need to be cautious of in New Zealand is the element I spoke about in that LinkedIn post, in that they're making a real differentiation between farms that supply them fresh milk. So that's where the milk tanker goes. It collects the milk, it goes to the factory, they put it in a vat there, and they use that directly in their food. Versus that ingredients side. So while Nestle are working with Fonterra, I wonder if that's because we've actually got a lot of good understanding of that possibly regen system here. We're already quite a long way towards what could be seen as regen. I know there's real trouble sort of defining regen being able to call it that on pack, because regen in itself is kind of undefinable. So I won't go into that today, because I'm by no means an expert. But I think we do need to be cautious of particularly how our ingredients are used. Again, we talk about grass-fed. We're really, really proud of our grass-fed systems and like the increased levels of omega-3s that come through into the milk and the meat. But again, if it's in a Kit Kat, is that omega-3 really going to be appreciated, or does it matter so much? So context is everything, unfortunately.
Yeah, if I look at the milk in my brother's fridge, it's organic milk, right? But it's got three additives that I feel should not be in there. I mean, there's an argument, if you go through some of the processes, there's less vitamin A, so they replace it. I myself buy directly from an organic farmer in Southland. So I'm like I'm the extremist probably. Maybe if we can talk a bit about the future. So I spoke to someone, and I kind of have to be cryptic because I cannot remember if this was off the record, so I can't really name names of who they were working for. I spoke to someone a while ago. Let's call them a thought leader. That's the weirdest. A thought leader is a weird thing. Am I a thought leader because I just post on LinkedIn random stuff all the time? I don't think so.
Definitely.
Okay, thank you. That is literally the biggest compliment I've ever had. If I tell my wife I've been called a thought leader, I'll get back to you on what she said. But So this
added person, to your profile.
Yes, that's a great thing to do. So this person is in a position where they advise government, and they spoke about in I cannot remember, it was 100 years or 200 years, they don't think any cows are going to exist. And I was like, seriously, are we going that far? Like, when I say that, what do you think? Do you think it's pushing a specific narrative too far? Like, Have these things crossed your mind? Like, what do you think if you hear something like that?
It's funny, it's sort of crossing that line between the hype cycle and the reality. Cows will exist, but not in the same context as today. So again, the size of our herds in New Zealand in a global context is absolutely bonkers. When you start looking at average herd sizes around the world, or I went to Chicago in October last year to talk at the International Dairy Federation conference and met loads of farmers over there whose herd sizes were sort of in the 1 to 200 cow region. And that's in the US, where their population is so much bigger than ours. And I did a bit of work before I went and looked at the population. So New Zealand has about 2% of the population of the US, but about 53% of the cow population, dairy cow population of the US. So, that ratio of population to herd, dairy herd size is really incredible when you start looking into that detail. So I agree in a way. Cows will not exist. You won't be driving through Southland and seeing anywhere near the herds of cows. But you might see people having a couple in their back paddock. I see this return to self-sufficiency or community sufficiency. I really love that idea.
I do too.
And I think with the current geopolitical stage of the world, other countries will be looking at that too. And while a lot of our milk goes overseas at the moment, I'm not sure whether that will be, in the next 50 years, whether that will be the future. There's an interesting case study when you look at Qatar. So they used to get all of their milk from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's got giant dairy farms in the desert, produce huge amounts of milk. When Saudi Arabia cut Qatar off because of perceived links with the Taliban, Qatar were like, fine, we've got lots of money, we'll just buy cows from Europe. So they bought in a heap of cows from Europe, and within a year they were fully self-sufficient for dairy. Now Qatar's in the desert, so they don't grow grass and they don't
So
have
they're bringing
feed, and
in feed.
they have to buy it in, and they don't have lots of water, so they have to use desalination plants that are incredibly expensive. So while it doesn't make any sense for them to export dairy, they have become self-sufficient for their population. And then when you look at some of the work they're doing, they've signed six memorandums of understanding with the Algerian government. So Algeria, after China, is our second biggest customer of whole milk powder. So China by the most, and that's decreasing. Algeria by the second highest amount, and that is increasing. However, they are also looking at this Qatari technology to build dairy farms in the desert. That doesn't seem to be talked about or ring any alarm bells. That information is from Lucy Duma, who is she was a Nuffield scholar last year. Really interesting work that she's put out there. But again, global food security is going to become so much more of a driver for countries. You look at the US, Biden has signed a huge amount of money and a White House white paper, I think they're called. Executive order, White House executive order about biotechnology. And that goes into food security, it goes to the USDA to develop strategies and policies to do with growing biotechnology. It also looks at things like space travel and their army and the defense force, because it's perfect for whether it's disaster relief or if they've got people out there in countries where there's famine or where there's not the you can't grow cows and milk them. It's a great opportunity to produce high quality protein and get that into people who are doing tricky jobs.
Wow. Yeah, I think my idea of fairness is that every dairy shed, in the future, someone's herd might be half the size or a quarter of the size, but they'll have like a mini precision fermentation chamber in their dairy shed. So they're selling, milk and this product, and then those people can still survive. But obviously, that's I, yeah, you know, I have these flights of fancies.
That's not too far away from the truth. So possibly not in the dairy shed, because of the level of sophistication that will be required to run this technology. But if you look at our big dairy factories, if you look at all of our spray dryers that exist around the country, what's called the downstream technology. So if you switched over the vat of milk that comes in the tanker, if you switch that over for a fermentation vessel, the rest of the process is actually exceptionally similar to processing dairy. So you've got to spin it really, really fast to separate out the milk and the cream, which would also separate out the fermentation liquor from the protein. You then use membranes, you use evaporation and spray drying. All of that technology is the same across precision fermentation and our dairy ingredients processing industry. So there are opportunities there. I don't think the export opportunities will be the same. There's some really cool technology in Australia. Australia have embraced this with both hands. There's a company called Cauldron Firm. So what they're doing is they're building these mini cauldrons, they call them, and which is fermentation vessels, and they're putting them in rural areas. And they've done that for a reason. It's because that's where they grow sugarcane. So sugarcane is one of the major feedstocks for fermentation at the moment. And it's also one of the major barriers to it scaling up is that feedstock availability. Mm. So by putting these cauldrons in areas, I think they've got one in Orange, which is a really agricultural area, and it's also a mining area. So there's going to be that need for just transition for people's high paid roles to start moving towards new industries. So that's a really cool example of how fermentation can actually be distributed regionally, give opportunities for people to produce food, but in a very different way to how we do at the moment.
Wow. I think also what will save a lot of people is the fact that you've got, English is my second language and I now forgot. Fonterra is a, with everyone supplying to them, cooperative. The cooperative model is going to save a lot of, let's call it a worst case scenario. The dairy industry completely changes and precision fermentation does take over to extend the market within the cooperative situation. And if these cooperatives embrace this in the way that you're talking about, the farmer will still get the money because they're part of the cooperative. The company is still making, that's what I think. And the money would in some way still trickle down to them if it's their company doing that. Do you think that's why these companies are investing in that? Like why Fonterra is doing it so they can, if there's a transition, they can do a slow transition? Or is that too simplistic?
I don't want to speak for Fonterra, but obviously they have got a huge amount of money invested in the technology that can really only be used for cow dairy farming, you know? So because of our seasonal production system, we produce a lot of milk all at once. So just after calving, September, October, we have peak milk. Fonterra have to have the capacity to process all of that milk within 4 days of it leaving the cow. They have to make it into something that is tradable and has a long shelf life. So that has meant we've built a huge amount of spray drying capacity. And so we're kind of beholden to that spray drying dairy infrastructure that we have. So for someone like Fonterra to pivot, while they're in that market, they're exploring it, they're using their connections and their expertise to explore it. I would question whether the benefits of them being in that industry will totally outweigh the potential negatives for particularly dairy farmers in New Zealand. And I can't remember the percentage, but it's a huge percentage of dairy farms that are still in family ownership. And the other thing about dairy farms is that most of them are quite debt laden. So there's not many farms that are owned outright. And actually, milk solids at the moment are the best way to keep paying down that debt off this dairy land that we have. So we can talk about things like diversification away from dairy, and we can talk about things like reducing herd sizes, but actually in the context of the debt situation that a lot of dairy farmers in, that is a really tricky situation that's not often highlighted.
So are you mentioned a bit of it, but are you being consulted by big companies? I mean, you're speaking to some of them, but are the big wigs calling you in for conversations, or do you think they're having that behind closed doors?
I'd love to be. Like, I've built up this huge amount of pretty useless knowledge, to be honest. And no, I don't have a lot of work in this space. So yeah, happy to talk to anyone that would like to see how it might affect them. But there are some dairy companies that are interested. I often chew off our A2 milk company people's ears about this, and they're on board, they get it, and they're awesome to talk to about it. But I'm sure Fonterra have got people doing things in the background, but they have to be really careful about what they say, particularly being a farmer-owned cooperative. One thing I would ask is that farmers in positions of influence, so whether that's farmers on shareholder councils for Fonterra or people on agri boards, they start thinking about what the risks are from this to their business, because there isn't anyone, well, there aren't very many people keeping an eye on it. And those people that we trust to give us this information, at the moment, I don't think it's coming through. So I do a little bit of consulting for NZX, who do all the dairy trading. I write for their monthly newsletter, and a few bits of work with other companies, but yeah, not a huge amount at the moment.
What questions should I be asking as a journalist?
Why are we still dairy farming? That's what a lot of people ask. Like, why, if you think this is such a risk, why are you guys still in it? And there's a few reasons for that. I mentioned the fact that dairy is still at the moment the best way to make money from the land that we have, and you know, we've got an overdraft that our bank manager would quite like to see paid back sometime. And then the other side of it is we're really happy being with A2 Milk Company through Mataura Valley Milk. They do a lot more direct consumer products. It's a differentiated offering. It's obviously a cost to the business to go full A2. But we believe that's worth it. It's a product that's actually appreciated as milk rather than an anonymous ingredient that goes into food products. But that's not an opportunity. You know, we can't, as New Zealand, all switch to making consumer products because we just simply make so much milk. You know, in 2021, Fonterra made 74% of the milk solids they processed into ingredients, and they have an ambition to reduce that, and they do really, really cool things with probiotics and infant nutrition and other products, but they don't use enough milk. That's the thing. Like, infant nutrition contains about 20% milk, and the rest is imported vegetable oils and sugars and things like that, which sounds gross, but actually that's to mimic breast milk. But yeah, it's when you start to look at that context, it's really quite an interesting and exposed position we're in.
I saw a post, it's actually an article Richard Rennie from Farmers Weekly wrote about some of the IP Fonterra has. I don't know why we're talking about Fonterra the whole time, sorry, but around
Open country.
how some of these things work in the gut microbe biome. And there's a lot of interesting things that I also want to investigate. I didn't really tell you that we're going to talk about this, but what questions are you guys asking on the farm? Maybe not necessarily pertaining to this, but like you're sitting in a situation where, I mean, the can has been kicked down the road for greenhouse gas measurements or attacks. Like, what are the questions that you guys have on the farm that concern you for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years? I don't know.
Oh, it's interesting. It's actually changed our mindset having a 2-year-old and seeing him sort of wandering around the farm and loving it, and just thinking about what the farm, if he decided to be a farmer, what it would look like in 25 years' time. And very different as my answer to that. So some of the questions we're looking at are, how can we go further and faster than the average? So obviously there's a lot of farms, and not all of them will survive. That's the sad truth of the fact. and it's only the ones that are sort of taking every opportunity to do the additional work, whether that's planting, whether that's we use the Alltech eCO2 measurement for our footprinting. That's all through our milk company, and that's been really interesting to be a part of. What else do we do? Yeah, we basically just any opportunity to do something extra, we try and grab it with both hands. But that takes resource and it takes knowledge, and it takes, we're in a really privileged position in that, you know, I'm not working, like Pete's had a university education, like we've got time, and I've got a technical background to be able to understand that, but not everyone does. And actually, if you're out there milking the cows at 4 a.m, you don't want to come home at 10 o'clock at night and go on your computer and do an assessment of what your emissions are. So I do appreciate it. We're lucky in that aspect.
Yeah, it's interesting. Diversification is going to become more important in future. I work a lot with agritourism, and I've spoken to a lot of farmers who have an awesome, you know, little old school on their farm that they can turn into accommodation, but they're not just not interested. So these questions are things that should be asked now, because once you need to ask the questions, it's possibly too late. But Anna, yeah.
I'll just say one more thing. There's a brilliant expression that comes from Angela Clifford that I know you did a fantastic podcast with her a while ago as well. But she's a very, very clever lady doing some very cool stuff. But she talks about she talks about a patchwork of lots of different diversification elements. And there's not going to be one great big thing that, you know, we turn from sheep and beef, we change to dairy. There's not going to be a new one that we all switch to. There's going to have to be lots of different options and ways of looking at it.
Yeah, for sure. I believe, and I think that doesn't just count for farmers. I mean, it probably counts for the person who's got a day job that needs to make ends meet. So I mean, that counts for us all. Is there anything you think I should have asked or that you want to say out there, or are we, is this it, and we'll talk again in the next year about how things have changed? What do you think?
I'd love to know what farmers and people invested in the industry want to know. So obviously I post a lot on LinkedIn, but there's not a lot of farmers on LinkedIn. I have dabbled, I go forwards and backwards about whether to go into other social media to start to get the message out there. When you wrote that article on me in stuff, that was posted, someone posted it on one of the Facebook groups, and it got lots of quite negative comments on it about me. And I found that quite hard, especially when my profile picture was me and my little boy. So I'm a bit hesitant to do it, but I care so much about it. I'm not anti-dairy. It's just getting that message across. And it's quite a detailed and a message that needs to have the context behind it, so it doesn't necessarily suit quick social media posts. Just really interested to hear if what people want to know about and the format they'd love to know about it in.
Cool. Yeah, maybe Navigate is a way to not put your face onto it, so it's Navigate saying it. But yeah, even when I was working at Stuff, the moment you write something that's not just 100% supportive, there are a lot of people there willing to throw rocks, and that was something that quite caught me by surprise. I get that, but yeah. I'll in any case, when I visit farms, I will ask them what they think of it. But anyways, Anna, thanks. I really enjoy that. It's a very important topic, and I don't know why people aren't talking about it more, because it is going to influence us in future. And I find it very interesting, even though there's a lot of things where my knee-jerk reaction is, please stop the technology. I don't want this to happen. And I, but anyway, so Anna, thanks. I appreciate your time, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you.